Well, I'll be talking about some stuff today that we've done that kind of, I suppose, could connect the various themes of the workshop. So a little bit about fracture, a little bit about fraction, and maybe I can convince some of you that it might be relevant even to earthquakes. So I'll be talking about, first, the person who's done most of the work that I'll be talking about is a fellow named Shmuel Rubinstein, who's a student of mine, and this is done at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. What will we be talking about? Well, friction is generally considered to be a slow process. You know, creep goes at microns a second. Fast friction is millimeters a second. Fracture is fast. The typical speeds are the sound speeds in the material, kilometers per second or so. So generally, people, except maybe in the earthquake business, don't connect between the two of these animals. But what we'll be trying to do is show you that the onset of friction could well be kind of a hybrid. Okay, what we'll be talking about, very simple experiment. So this is an experimental talk, so I'll essentially be describing to you what we see and maybe sliding in a few interpretations along the way, if you'll allow me. But basically, the simplest experiment that you could conceive, this is dry friction. So we have two blocks, a normal force Fn, a shear force Fs. We're talking about a dry, there's no lubricant here, and it's a rough interface. And we're going to just push on this, so apply a given normal load and increase the shear load until at some stage this block will begin to move. And the only thing we'll be interested in today in this talk, other things we can talk about later, but it's just what happens, what are the dynamics at this point when this effective interface breaks loose? So how does the transition from static to dynamic friction occur? We'll be looking at the dynamics of that. This was just an opportunity to show that I can pull nice pictures off of the net, but the study of friction essentially is hundreds of years old, starting from Leonardo, who actually got it right, showing that basically the frictional force needed to move any block is only a function of the normal force. And he did experiments. He was probably both a theorist and experimentalist, but he showed that the only thing you had to worry about was pushing, was applying a certain normal force. The geometry didn't matter at all of the block, and that the frictional force, or the shear force that one had to apply to the block to get it to move, was directly proportional to the normal force, independent of the area, or the contact area of the block, or the ostensible contact area of the block. 200 years later, Monton and Coulomb essentially wrote this down as an equation and added the fact that there's a static and dynamic friction coefficient. So to get the thing to move, you have a certain friction coefficient, the static one. When it's moving, to keep it moving, you have to apply a different force that's proportional to this. This is the dynamic friction coefficient, which is always less than the static one. Okay, 250 years later, Bowden and Tabor came and explained the Coulomb-Mamonton law. And they just showed that you have to take into account not the nominal contact area, but the net contact area, the honest-to-God real contact area between the two interfaces. So nearly any interface, except if you're very, very careful, is rough at microscopic scales. So if one looks at the real contact area, one sees that you have a whole ensemble of point contacts that define the interface. And what Bowden and Tabor realized was that, for example, there are huge pressures at each one of these point contacts. And these pressures will cause the material to flow, and it'll actually increase the nominal contact area, until the pressure at each point is approximately equal to the yield stress of the material. So then you get this proportionality between the real contact area and the normal force that we're applying to the material. Motion occurs when we have these weld joints and we fracture them. So essentially, the shear force that we have to apply in order to get this thing to move is equal in this picture to the shear strength of each one of these contacts times the nominal surface area. So from this we get essentially the Coulomb law of friction. Now there are a number of enhancements to the law of friction that we just derived, and I won't get into them, for example, rate and state, because first of all, you know them probably better than I do, and second of all, they're not relevant to the experiments that I'll be talking about, because once again, we're looking just at the point where things start to move. Okay, what are we getting? This is an experimental talk. What's the experiment? We have two transparent blocks, one on top of another. This is a schematic view of the system. It actually looks a bit more complicated in real life. We're applying a normal force along the top of the slider, a shear force that's as close as we can get to the contact area. So there are very little moment here that we're applying. Now, what we're going to be doing in this experiment is we're going to directly visualize the real honest-to-God contact area along this interface and along the entire interface. And we're going to do this in the following way. We're going to illuminate the interface here with a laser sheet. A few technical details first. The experiments that I'll be talking about were done on plexiglass, also plexiglass on a glass base. We've artificially roughened the interface, and you'll see in this for a second why, to a roughness of about a micron. That's actually all you need to know. Okay, so we've now illuminated this interface, but we're going to illuminate it in the following way. We're going to illuminate it in a way that the light undergoes total internal reflection from the material air interface. So most of the light will be reflected back and we won't worry about it. The only light to be transmitted here is the light that goes through these point contacts. Now, the 1 micron roughness that we talked about, we need that because this light could essentially tunnel through from the base to the slider. The angle of incidence that we use, the tunneling distance is about 50 nanometers, so we're pretty safe in saying that all of the light that comes through here from the direct area of contact. Now we're taking this light and we're just imaging onto a fast camera, and we can take pictures at rates of about, depending on the resolution that we want, of up to about 250,000 frames per second. So what I hope to show you is that we are doing real-time imaging, or nearly real-time imaging of the entire fracture surface. So the intensity of this camera at each point X, Y, and T is what we'll be looking at, where X is defined as the propagation direction, or the direction at which we're applying the shear, Y is the transverse direction along the sample. Okay, first, does it work? It sounds good on paper. In order to at least convince ourselves that what we think we're doing is what we're actually doing, we did the following tests. Essentially, we repeated Jim Dietrich's work from 94. This time, we looked at the total intensity coming through the entire interface as a function of normal load. So, and we find, as we expect, that the intensity is a linear function of the applied load, which is what one would expect. Once again, remember the table, or the Bowden and Tabor picture, that the normal stress is proportional to the area. We claim that the intensity is also proportional to the real contact area, and we see that here. We can then go and compare this, for example, the normalized intensity to the frictional force necessary to get this thing to move. Once again, we see an approximate linear relationship. The scatter here isn't instrumental noise. It's not measurement error. It just comes from the fact that we weren't careful about the time, the lifetime of each of the contacts before we did the experiment. So this is essentially, the scatter is due to aging of the interface. Okay, so these static measurements are an additional verification, I guess, of Bowden and Tabor's theory. From now on, we'll just assume that the intensity that we're looking at every point is proportional to the amount of surface area, the real amount of surface area at each pixel along the interface. Yeah?
Presumably the
intensity
does not go to zero,
right? Yeah. I mean, these are the things that... No. Okay, let me tell you. Okay, what happens there is that at zero load, you start to get scattering. You don't, the contacts at these loads are on the order of a micron, a half a micron, so light just goes through. These are weld joints, essentially. So it's plexiglass on plexiglass, at least for most of the experiments that I'll be talking about. So you get a cold weld anyway. So adhesion you can't eliminate because it's there. But we haven't done any special treatment of the interfaces.
As you pointed out, the contact intensity is aging.
Yeah.
So are you measuring it at constant time? I mean, how are you actually taking it off the time?
You'll see in a minute, but it's a whole other talk what we see for aging, which I don't want to get into, but it's interesting. But right now we're going to be talking. This was just kind of a test, a proof of principle kind of thing. Now we'll look at the dynamics. Okay, so what are the dynamics? I'll try to show you that what we're seeing are coherent fronts, that are fronts of separation that move across the sample. And they're kind of crack-like. So what I'll try to show you is more or less that the onset of friction is kind of a dynamic fracture problem. The more or less part hopefully will become apparent later on. A quick primer about shear fracture for those that don't live it daily, I guess. The first thing one should know is that basically if you take a solid block of material, apply shear stress, you can break it, but the fracture at the tip of the tip of the crack that forms is essentially tensile. Mode one fracture is the rule. Now how can you get mode two or shear fracture to evolve? Only along a weak interface, which is essentially what the friction problem is about. Another thing to note is that shear cracks with point-like stress field singularities, as we're used to in the crack business, they have two important velocities. One is the limiting velocity, which is the Raleigh wave speed. So these cracks can propagate at any velocity up until the Raleigh wave speed. And there's also a special velocity, which is the square root of 2 times the shear wave speed, which cracks are allowed from energy constraints to travel at. You can kind of get around these limitations if you decide that the crack can be a distributed sink and not a point-like shear stress field singularity. And when you do that, then you can allow any other shear velocities to occur. And this is just a simulation that I stole from Alan Needleman's website showing essentially this. So we're going to start. This is a crack that's going to move from left to right. We're starting at a point-like singularity here, and this is going to accelerate. And all of a sudden, you'll see that okay, it's point-like, 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 and then boom, it becomes a spatially distributed source. Starts to move faster than the speed of sound at intersonic speeds, and this shock wave develops. These simulations were inspired by the experiment. The first one was done with Demir Kocur and Aris Rosakis in 99, at which this is a picture stolen from one of Aris's papers, but essentially this is the shock wave that one sees when the crack moves intersonically. What I need for you to remember here to kind of normalize the results that we'll be talking about is that most cracks will move up until the Raleigh wave speed, but some can move beyond. And the ones that move beyond are these intersonic cracks. Okay, what do our results show? Here's a nice picture of this. Is here the contact area is grayscaled. X is the direction of which we're applying shear, the long direction. Y is the transverse direction. The aspect ratio is screwed up, so you'll be able to see something. I'll show you a movie of what occurs now when detachment will happen from left to right. So this is kind of a typical experiment. Okay, so nothing happens, and then, boom, we see a front moving from the side where shear was applied across the sample. Yeah, weight is, I just killed it, I guess. I did that. Okay. Yeah, weight is high area of contact. Dark is reduced area. Gray is kind of where we started from. Okay, now. Yeah, yeah. And if you'll notice, this is darker than the gray that we started from. There's a lot of dynamics happening in the front. I'll talk about it in a second. But this is basically the kind of data that we'll be looking at. Here's a picture of it. So here's our normalized front, or a normalized interface in the beginning. Then we see that a quasi one-dimensional front will sweep across the material at a given velocity v, and we'll talk about this. Okay, the reason I'm showing you all this is to convince you that it is quasi one-dimensional. So what we're going to do now for the rest of this talk is to collapse all the data along a single line. So we'll be talking about, I'll be ignoring totally this transverse direction and just look at the intensity as a function of x and time and t that we'll see. So. Yeah. It's fixed. Okay. Good question. What am I thinking about, or what am I selling? That's okay. What we're seeing is reduced contact area, but it doesn't go to zero. There's still residual contact area when this front is moving along. What I think we see, but this is just kind of an educated guess right now, is separation, and hopefully we'll have the equipment to measure it, but probably not by the end of the conference. So. Ah, this business here.
Well, it starts out uniform gray almost.
Yeah.
White.
Yeah. I won't be talking about it in this talk now. Do I have a good idea of what's happening? I have some guesses, but right now I'm going to duck the question if you don't mind. We can talk about it later, but okay. Anyway, this is, instead of gray now, we've shifted to blue. Each one of the lines along this picture is the interface collapsed along the propagation direction as a function of time. So time is increasing here. The distance along the interface goes from 0 to 15 centimeters or so. Okay, what do we see? One thing, the larger the slope, the slower the thing that you're looking at is going, because I've kind of switched time and space here. So your intuition, you have to switch your intuition as well. Okay, we see essentially three different types of fronts that propagate here. This is triggered by a front which moves, which starts at a few hundred meters per second and accelerates to the Raleigh wave speed of around 1,000 meters per second here. What we find is that this trigger front, if we want, once it reaches approximately the Raleigh wave speed, it then branches, it dies, and it gives rise to an intersonic propagation going at around close to the square root of 2 of the shear speed, but we don't have the resolution to pin it down more than 10% here. But it's certainly intersonic, and at the same time it gives rise to a pulse that's moving 2 orders of magnitude less. This is a logarithmic scale here. This, for lack of probably imagination, we call a slow front, because it's pretty slow. Now these slow fronts will propagate and will sometimes transition back to sub-Raleigh or near-Raleigh wave speed fronts, as they do here. And when we reach the end of the sample, we get actually an intersonic rebound front, which goes backwards, and that's what this is showing here. Okay, this is your typical experiment. What can we say about this stuff? Okay, so both intersonic and slow fronts are emitted upon the arrest of these sub-Raleigh fronts. So these things are moving as fast as they can possibly move. Remember, the Raleigh wave speed is the limit at which these things can move. It gets there, boom, bifurcates to these two different types of fronts. Three distinct families of fronts, and we'll see in a minute how we can characterize them. These slow ones move at, I think the fastest slow front that we've seen has approached about a tenth of the Raleigh wave speed. These are about 10 different experiments. These are the mean velocities of all of them. Sub-Raleigh are here, once again, on a logarithmic scale, and you can see the separation between the two types of fronts. Yeah, and I'll show in a second. Okay, now, Aris's group has been involved in similar experiments looking through photoelasticity. We wanted to see whether these slow fronts could be picked up by the photoelastic method. So this is kind of your basic photoelastic visualization primer here. And this is a movie of what we see. So we'll be looking now at the propagation from right to left. This is... we're looking now along this plane here. So the interface is just this line separating the base and the slider. I've colored them in so you could see it. And we'll let this thing run. This is a movie that's running at about 30,000 frames per second. What we'll see here is there'll be some organization, and then see this guy? That's our slow pulse. He's moving across. It's going to hit approximately here and transition to a fast front, which one frame and it's gone. So this is, so I guess two take-home lessons from this. One, that you can see them using photoelastic methods. And two, that if you're not looking for very long times, you won't see this guy. Okay. Our experiments have been done in plexiglass. An obvious question that one might ask, is this some kind of a weird polymer effect, or are these, for example, these slow pulses more general than that? So we looked in the literature and came upon the beautiful experiments of Vonaka's group. And this is kind of, this is stolen from his paper. Essentially what they did was they sandwiched a slab of granite, which is labeled B here, between two other slabs of granite, pushed it from the top, and instrumented the A-B interface by an array of strain gauges and displacement sensors. Now, this is a discrete array, and we have a few more points than they do, about 2 orders of magnitude more points. But essentially, they looked at the strain as a function of time. These things have a very fast response. They have a microsecond to response time. What do they see? Interface roughnesses comparable to what we're looking at, they indeed see, and you have to, this is stolen from, except for the subtitles here, this is stolen from his paper. They see something that looks like a slow front that indeed transitions to a rapid sub-Raleigh front. The Raleigh wave speed in granite, I think, is 4 or 5 kilometers per second, so this is on the order of the Raleigh wave speed. This is, as we see, close to 2 orders of magnitude lower. So there's some, this is kind of evidence for the generality of what we're looking at. This is obviously not a polymer. Well, this is obviously not a polymer. Let's talk about slip. I'll define slip as local movement or local displacement along the interface, whereas sliding we'll just define as overall movement of the two blocks, just to get kind of terminology correct. And we're going to be looking, so this experiment is essentially the transition from slip to sliding, or I guess the transition from static to dynamic friction. Let's take a look at another, this is a different experiment. Here, distance is actually now the y-axis and time is the x-axis, so high slopes are now high velocities. At the same time, this graph below on the same time scale is measuring the slip at the trailing edge of the sample, in other words, the edge at which we're applying shear stress. One thing that we see is that no slip, or virtually no slip, occurs as a result of the intersonic pulse. The intersonic front is moving, has traversed this within one or two lines here at this time scale, but you see very little at time zero, very little slip on the trailing edge of the sample. Slip occurs over the duration of the experiment. So you can generally see slip moving. In this case, this jump we attribute to this sub-Raleigh pulse that started the thing. The sub-Raleigh, I'm using pulse, but it's actually a front. I have no. And then this transitions to the slow front, and we see the slip as a result of that here. Sliding only occurs. In other words, this leading edge is pinned until this front reaches the edge of the sample. There's no movement here, and we can detect it to submicron resolution of this leading edge until either the slow pulse or the slow front or a sub-Raleigh front, if we have a transition to that, reaches this edge. Only then do we have any movement. And at that time, we start to see sliding. I mentioned that we're looking at the transition from static to dynamic friction. Let's quantify that a little bit. So what we'll be doing here, this is the same experiment, but now we're going to integrate at each time slice over the total contact area. And we can see that we have a dip in the relative area of contact by about 12% over the course of the experiment, which is the same as the normalized difference between the static and dynamic friction coefficients of plexiglass. Yeah. Well, you detach the interface. Something's moving here. Something. So yeah, maybe it's the wrong terminology. I guess we should talk about that. I'm not sure this is separation, but I think it is. But we have yet to prove it. Okay. No, this is global. This is an integration over the whole interface. So now we're going back to a block-on-block friction experiment, and this is the global coefficient of friction, or the difference between the global coefficients of friction. The intensity is local, but what I'm showing here is the integrated intensity over the whole front, over the whole interface. Okay, over here you can see, by the way, the initiation of aging, but I won't talk about that. But actually, as the thing starts to slide, the surface already starts to reheal. And this is typical of what we see. I have about 30 seconds, so. Slow fronts are much more efficient than the other two for surface detachment. The intersonic fronts in our experiments are nearly invisible because they only detach maybe about 1% of the total surface area. I could summarize, but I won't because I want to connect this in some sense to earthquakes, if I can have 30 more seconds or so. Okay, Bruce is kind of getting edgy or something, so yeah.
I'm doing your job.
Yeah, no, you're doing your job, that's good. Okay, earthquakes, sub-Raleigh fronts, these are garden variety earthquakes. Intersonic fronts have been seen, for example, in these Meat earthquake in 99. What about these slow fronts? Do they have any relevance to earthquake dynamics at all? And we started to look in the literature and noticed that, you know, recently the slow earthquakes or silent earthquakes have been popping up more and more in the literature. And they have various characteristics, one of which is an weak atypical seismic signature. So I guess the question is, are these things related to these things? And I have some stuff that I won't have time to talk about, but I just want to show you the last slide. Okay, we've done acoustic emissions, for example, of these. These are four shocks. This first thing, this is the main shock. Let's compare the acoustic emissions of a four shock to the main shock. Okay, this is just a measurement of the displacement of the leading edge, just proving that this is the main shock. Okay, these are acoustic emissions that this thing, this thing generated. These are acoustic emissions that the main shock generated. Look at this little thing here. And now we're going to compare it. This is 15 seconds now. These are acoustic emissions showing what people believe to be the emissions, the seismic emissions due to slow earthquakes. And just for comparison, see this little bump here, which is not apparent when there are no slow fronts launched by the system. So I guess I'll stop now and thank you for your attention.
Yeah. Well, just a comment for clarification, first of all, the slow is the initial phaser with higher frequency? This is the slow?
Yeah, this is the slow, and what we see, one thing that I didn't
stress... But does it have higher frequency?
Yeah, but you know, you have a lot of filtering going on in seismic signals. Here we don't. We have actually a lot of...
Okay. I have a comment about the comparison you made with Onaka's experiment. I think what you see there is actually nucleation phase.
Yeah.
In contrast to your slow phase, I mean, the difference is that the nucleation phases are just localized. They occur in one region in space. Once they reach certain critical size, that's it, and you get fast rupture going. Mm-hmm. And that's what is shown in Onaka's experiment and also in the rate and state friction. But in your case, you have a slow phase, actually, that is not just limited to a small region in space, but it continues to propagate across the entire interface, so it's different than the nucleation, the slow nucleation.
It may or may not be because we're confining our system to be a one-dimensional system, whereas if you have a two-dimensional fault, a nucleation patch might be the same thing, so it's still, the jury's still out, I guess, but yeah, I agree.
But physically, it's a different thing. What you're arguing, you have a slow detachment that kind of prepares the entire surface.
Yeah.
The occurrence of dynamic rupture. That's different from the radiation. It just has to grow to a critical size, mm-hmm. and then without preparation, the rest of the
interface
will be
dynamic. Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on that a little bit, and perhaps you could explain how you initiate the instabilities in these experiments, and where that roughly radio wave front is coming from.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because we normally do see that nucleation type process first.
Yeah, okay. The way the experiment is conducted is we very adiabatically ramp up the shear stress. But there's a small moment, about 2%, because we can't really push along the interface plane, so there's always some uplift at the trailing edge of the sample. This, we believe, gives rise to these trigger.
Is this really fast?
Oh, the ramping?
Yeah.
Oh, no, it's 10 microns a second up to. So it has nothing, it's different scales altogether than anything that we're seeing here.
Thank you. I wanted to ask whether sucking air into the interface is an important role. If you took the air away or replaced it with a higher viscosity fluid, would that matter? I was thinking of viscous fingering. I mean, you really have to. It's almost like moving a suction cup. You got to get air under there.
Good question. Don't know. We haven't done it yet.
You said you were going to tell us how far it moved in each pulse, but I don't remember seeing that. Can you tell us what the actual displacement is and, for example, how it would compare to typical contact sizes?
Okay, the displacement... Okay, I'd have to find this... Okay, here's our slip. Now, the contact sizes are on the order of a micron. The spacing between them is on the order of 10 microns. We've done some AFM studies on the surface before we actually did anything to it. The slip is tens of microns. So, now this is, once again, the slip at the trailing edge. And right now we're working on, and we don't have it instrumented yet, but we want to look at the displacement velocities and slips at different points along the sample. But right now we only have the trailing edge and the leading edge. Right here, this little bump. Yeah, I mean, this is the sub-Raleigh pulse over here. It's zero, it starts. What? Yeah.
Have you studied what happened during stop of sliding? Do you have stopping waves, just like you're starting with?
Yeah, but I don't... We can talk about it later. I don't have the data right here, and it's still stuff that's... But sure, I mean, the same experimental apparatus can look at rehealing and such, and we have some nice data actually on aging and how far you can push this logarithmic aging that one sees. I think we can, but I don't have the data here to talk.